Interview with Catherine Kinney, November 5th, 2009, in New York City by Kenneth Durr.
I want to start with the obvious, is how you ended up coming to work for the New York Stock Exchange.
Okay. I was graduating in 1974 from a very small liberal arts college in Westchester County, and I was a language major, and my intention had been accepted to Georgetown to go to the School of Linguistics for a master's degree, with the intention of either going into foreign service or into academe. And my father got very sick, and he was pushing me very hard to get a deferral and to get a job.
Okay.
So I went to the college counseling office, and it turned out that they had a relationship with the exchange and had recruited from the exchange for a number of years. And I went into the office and said, okay, if I'm going to really defer my plan, I really want to do something completely different than what I was intending to do. And so there was a sign up that the New York Stock Exchange was coming to recruit, and I thought, well, I don't know anything about the exchange. I don't really know anything about financial services, and that I would learn something every day. So I put my name down, and they canceled the interview subsequently, but I called up because I was very interested then, because I'd done some research, very different than the research you do today. And I asked them if I could come down for an interview, and they, after a lot of back and forth, they said, okay, I could come down. So in April, I went down for an interview. And they said there were no jobs. It was 1974, a terrible recession, no jobs. And I was working at Dry Dock Savings Bank, which I had done every summer when I was in college. And they called and asked if I would come down for an interview and asked if I had found a job. This was in early August, like the first week in August. So I said, no, I hadn't. So I went down for the interview, and they offered me a job. And I took it. And the job was in regulation. It was a job as a senior clerk performing a task that no longer even exists. And it was more of a reconciliation of transactions that had occurred. So if two trades were being put together and they failed, my job was to try to resolve those trades on the floor of the exchange. And so my job, they hired another liberal arts major, two of us. And so for half of our day, we were given this task to do. And then we were basically put out on loan to anybody in the regulatory group who needed work done, whether that was research or writing memorandum. I mean, I think we were, this other gentleman and I were pretty good writers. So in any event, we were on loan to anybody on the management team who needed help.
Who was heading up regulation at this point?
Jerry O'Donohue.
Okay.
And I worked in the group that had market analysis, investigations. It was that group in regulation. So it was market surveillance, not enforcement or member firm regulation. So this was market surveillance. So these were the people that were all responsible for overseeing the trading floor and what happened on the floor. But anyway, we had this job that lasted for about, I would say, we were in those roles for maybe 6 months, 8 months. And then I moved into transaction or market analysis, and we were rotated through there. And then we were given jobs in the investigatory group, investigations, and then I went up to member trading. So there wasn't really a formal training program, but we were moved from group to group. So this was now, that was 74, so now this is about 77. And the exchange has just decided that they're going to deploy technology into the business model. And we had now formed the Securities Industry Automation Corporation was formed in 74. DTCC was formed at the same time. So that whole infrastructure was put in place. And they were going to start using technology. And SIAC was really going to be the principal arm of development and operations. But they wanted people on the business side to really define what the technology was meant to do. At the time, we also, John Phelan emerged as a very senior person on the floor. He was a specialist at the time. And Jim Needham, who was the first chairman of the board, so to speak, was then succeeded by Mill Batten, who was the first paid chairman of the exchange. So we had Mill Batten there, and so Mill was really the person who was, and John Phelan were driving the exchange to really start thinking about how technology was going to be important. And John really was the spearhead of it. And it was very unusual because he was a member. And, it was unusual that they would be pushing themselves. So anyway.
There's the, we want to keep it the way it is.
That's right. Absolutely. So I had, was, so there was a gentleman in the group that I was working in regulation, who was a real star. His name was Charlie Moore. He went on to become the chairman of the Boston Stock Exchange. But Charlie was identified by John Phelan as a real, I think a real young talent. And so Charlie said to me, aren't you going to apply for these jobs? There were two jobs in this newly formed product development group, who was run by a guy who came over from SIAC, Chris Keith. And, I said, well, I don't really have any experience. And he said, well, I think you should apply. So I applied and I got hired into this group. And the two products that I was responsible for were the Intermarket Trading System, or ITS, and SuperDot, which was also being crafted and built as a way to take orders from the broker-dealers to the floor of the exchange and back electronically. So those were my two products, and I was really responsible, much as you would hear in a packaged goods kind of environment, for every dimension of it. It was the policy, the regulation, the pricing, the technology, every dimension of these two products, and I was supposed to be at least managing that.
Do you have teams working on this?
There were two of us. No, I was a team of one, basically, and Charlie and Chris. But it was, it was a small group. And then there was a guy who did the bond system and one other system. So I really got the two plum, really, the two most important products. And it was really revolutionary. We were going to link all the, coming out of the 74, the SEC 74, 75 Acts amendments, we were required to disclose information about transactions and quotations, and we were also required to link markets so that investors could get the best possible price. No matter where they entered, they were always guaranteed the best possible price. So our challenge was to link the brokers first. Well, at the same time, we were linking the brokers and we were also linking the exchanges. So that I did, I was in that role until about 19... in and out because I had a child in the middle, in that role to 1984. And we really did a lot to build out these systems, improve them. We had a limit order book. I mean, we did a lot of very transformational things.
Where did the technology come from? Who did you license things from
it was
people?
All
did
built. It was all designed and built by SIAC in those days. Now, they had outside vendors they worked with. IBM, for example, was really responsible, and probably even to today, was responsible for all the back end, the processing.
Right.
And but most of the front end was built by SIAC directly.
So you'd been in market surveillance, the enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you talked about this process of evolving around.
Right.
Presumably, you'd learned about everything about the stock exchange so that you could go in and design this program. Did it work that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, knowing everything about trading, after 35 years, I can still say no one knows that.
Yeah.
But I knew enough about the process and the operation of the specialist, and I knew enough about the order routing to at least, I knew enough about how things worked.
Mm-hmm.
Did I really know everything? No. And, it was a team of people that we pulled together, people from operations, people from technology, people from regulation, policy people. So we were a team, and we were really meant to, to move the exchange forward. I mean, we tried as best we could not to simply replicate the process, but to advance the process in a way that really the technology was enhancing our ability to do three things. One, John Phelan had us out talking to the industry about capacity, and he was the one who had us out talking to the industry about doing 125 million share a day. Now, I promise you, the street was like, it's never going to happen. We were doing 7 million shares a day, 10 million shares a day. It's never going to happen. But he wanted us to have technology that prepared us to do that kind of volume. So we were talking to the industry about how were we going to modify, what was the change process that we were going to have to take ourselves through to really make that happen, to do it with lower error rates, so we were continuously lowering risk, because people knew where they stood at any given moment. So we were focusing on risk, we were focusing on capacity, we were focusing on performance of the systems. They had to be ultimately reliable so that people knew they could come in and out and get the best price. And we had all this technology we had to build to link the exchanges as well. So all of this was going on, and it was in that role until about 1984. And yeah, it was remarkable, because you know, you were bumping up constantly against the members who, and I mean that not only on the floor but even in the firms, who, you know, no one wanted to change. You know, they all felt that things were working well, and you know, it was going to stay like this for a long time. Well, but there were a lot of visionaries who saw it differently.
I mean, a lot of the systems you're talking about, though, were ultimately going back to the specialists, right?
They were. Everything was centered. The price discovery, correct. Price discovery was still happening at the point of sale, which was run by the specialist.
So you'd think that they would be okay with that kind of scenario.
But everyone, even, you know, everyone kept seeing that, or thinking that, the efficiency would continue to progress, and that the process would, you know, be developed sufficiently to be able to create price discovery in a box. Now, of course, you remember, alongside of this, NASDAQ started in 1968, so it was chugging along in a parallel fashion, as were all of the regional exchanges, with fully electronic models. That was Philadelphia, Pacific, Chicago. Everyone had a fully electronic model but the New York. But the New York still was really the market share. We did price discovery. Everybody else priced their merchandise around their order flow, around our pricing.
Yeah, and you were handling a lot more volume, too.
We were handling a lot more volume. We were probably handling multiples of the combined volume of all those markets. But they were growing, and they were taking share, and they were getting listings of local companies. So, you know, we didn't have multiple listings at that time, but that progressed and also became the way of things. So I did that till 1984, and then John Phelan asked me if I would start a sales and marketing team to go out and talk about all the technology we had built and what we were trying to do. So I did that. I started this group because we were competing in those days against the regional exchanges. They were becoming more, and NASDAQ in those days, for order flow as well as for listings.
Did you work with the SEC much on this?
Oh, my God. The relationships between the regional exchanges, the SEC, because the SEC was also responsible for taking the 75 Acts amendments and giving it and breathing life into it.
Building a national market.
Correct. And having that done in conjunction with the exchanges. So they were very much spearheading the actual development of that national market.
Who did
and
you
all
talk
the rules.
To?
Oh my gosh,
do you
I'm
remember?
Trying to remember. You know, Rick Ketchum was clearly there. Bob Colby was there. And I would say they were probably the two go-to people that were really at the forefront of, you know, they were there at that time.
How concerned was the stock exchange about NASDAQ in particular sort of moving in and cutting out their business?
I don't think in those days they were very worried about that, because it was very clear that the listings business and the trading business were linked, and they were separate. You know, the companies that went to NASDAQ were not the companies that went to New York. They each had their model for how things were going to happen, and they were probably very appropriate to the kinds of companies that they had at the time, given both the size of the company, but the volume and the trading and that kind of thing. So they were really quite separate and running along a track. The competition came from two places, and still today. The competition came from the broker-dealers, who were able to, at that point in time, there was still a rule called 390. It was once called 394, then became 390. And in those days, it was modified slightly as part of the national market in the sense that the dealers could do agency trades, but they could not do principal trades in their own offices. So there was a way that the broker-dealers could internalize their order flow and execute it. So the real competition was the broker-dealer community as well as the regional exchanges in those days. The NASD or NASDAQ was really running on a parallel track.
This is the early 80s.
The early 80s, correct.
Okay. So Rule 390, despite that being in place, people were still trading off the exchange.
Yes, but it was a very small percentage of the trading. Because remember, okay, we were still in the transition to an institutional market. Remember, at the end of the 70s, a couple of fundamental things, 75 Acts Amendments and the abolition of fixed commissions. So from that in comes discount brokerage, but also ushers in a wave of a real fundamental change in mutual funds, discount brokerage, and passive investing, where institutions were becoming much more powerful than they were up to that point. So there was this whole sea change going on in the industry from a trading perspective, a pricing perspective, a technology perspective, and even a customer perspective.
And all the while the volume's going up.
All the while the volume's going up.
ITS, did you set benchmarks and try to meet them, fail to meet them? Because I know that in the discussions around the SEC, there was a lot of big ideas and then sort of stepping back away from some of these technologies.
No, I think that ITS, it's interesting. I think if you went back to some of the meetings that were held early on, there were things that maybe it was the SEC, I'm not even sure I remember completely at this point, but there were things that could have been done to make that more automated. And the regionals really, everyone rejected that. I want to say everyone rejected that for different reasons. Everyone wanted to basically still control the price discovery.
Including the New York Stock Exchange.
Including the exchange, including the regionals for that matter, because generally what was happening was they were guaranteeing the executions in their automated systems. So if, an order came in from, in those days, Merrill Lynch, it was generally the specialist on the floor of the Pacific Stock Exchange who took the other side of that trade and then in turn would use ITS to manage their position. So they still wanted to have some control about when and how and what. And I think the regionals didn't, nobody pushed as far as they might have for different reasons. The regionals were worried that if the New York Stock Exchange thought it was a good idea, it was clearly a bad idea for them. And I think the exchange saw that it had a major market share, and it was, the disruption of that was a cause of great concern.
And the bottom of all this is the black box.
Everybody's worried that a black box. But more importantly, I would say, and I still feel this way today, I think if you looked at what the role of the exchange was, it was to bring buyers and sellers together and to ensure that they got the best price in that auction at that given moment in time. May not have been the best price of the day, may not have been what, but it was the right price at that moment in time. And I think the exchange tried to stay true to that mission. But, of course, as in all of what's happened then and what's happening now, this is all about, how the world gets divided. And so I think there was a lot of groundbreaking things that went on in the development of ITS.
When did you start looking at the floor itself and automation?
That really happened in the late 70s. We started with market orders, and the first thing that happened was 100 share market orders. So Merrill Lynch could send a 100 share market order directly to the post where the specialist traded IBM. and the specialist could in turn respond back to that client in electronic format. And so all of the files for the customer and the firm were debited, and then, of course, separate submissions were made to the post-trade process. But we started with 100-share market orders. Now, everybody thought that's where it should have begun and ended. And then we went to larger market orders. And then limit orders were much more complex and much more challenging technology to build. We built some in the early 80s, and it wasn't very good.
Did it get implemented?
It did get implemented, but it wasn't very good. And then we realized what we needed to do. We needed to build more electronic books. And we knew at that time we were only doing day limits, then we had to do overnight orders. So we had to build the sophistication in to handle stocks that were going to go through multiple prices, that were going to be carried overnight. And in the early 80s, we fixed up and cleaned up both the technology and the service for limit order handling. And I think that coupled with market orders really put us on a path to build a fully electronic limit order book. And the first, our technology was always very interesting because we always seemed to put it in a place where something happened. And remember, we built these limit order books, and I would say the probably 85, 86, that time frame. And we started these books. The first stock was Pan American. And you probably remember Pan Am went through some very challenging times, and this was just at the outbreak of that. And, well, it was the outbreak of it doing well and then not doing so well, but it even. And I think Pan Am traded, I can't even remember, like 3 million shares that day. It was like, and it was on this electronic book. And it actually worked quite well. And then the next application for it was for the divestiture of AT&T. And it was, we took all of the stocks that were being divested and we put them on these electronic books so that we could actually handle the order flow. I probably remember there were a couple of, and I don't even remember the stocks at the moment, my memory is failing me, but there was, they used to call them Winchell wagons, and they would, because when Winchell would recommend a stock or talk about a stock, it would inevitably, in the, you know, it's the modern day Cramer, right?
Yeah.
They had these wagons where they would basically pigeonhole the limit orders by price, and that was the way they managed them. So we imagined that the volume in AT&T's divestiture would be very, very large because you had, I think, 8 stocks at the time. But anyway, all the stocks had a book, and it actually worked. And so that was sort of pushed it off on its real application on the floor.
Now,
this was 86.
These are all separate books.
All separate books. Correct.
So there's no way you can bring them together.
Well, actually, no. There was a book for AT&T, and you had buy orders and sell orders and market orders, and everything was processed in this book. Now, at the time, you're correct. We had basically one stock on one book at a time, but then ultimately we were able to figure out how to put multiple stocks on a single book so that the specialists could handle, because most specialists handled on average 8 stocks. But it took time. So this is all coming. We now have had these, quote, beta tests in 86. And we start pushing the specials to put these books. It's like now, and you can imagine the technology is ramping up at the firms quite aggressively. And the other thing that's occurring in the background of all this is program trading. And so derivatives markets are growing. Options markets are really flying. And people are starting to do arbitrage and to link synthetically futures, options, and cash. And we went out in 85, I remember, late 85, to talk to the major firms that were engaged in program trading. So the Morgan Stanley was one of the principal firms, Goldman Sachs, were the two principal firms at the time, Credit Suisse. And we told them about the system, because what was happening was those firms at the end of the day, they would reconcile the entire position at the end of the day, close it out or generally. And at the end of the day, they would bring shoeboxes of orders to the specialists. And want them to be participating in the closing price so that they could have their position or liquidate their position, establish or liquidate their position as they were linked to these other products. So we got the idea that we could build something called list processing so that we could have pre-programmed by the broker-dealers with our software the lists of orders. And generally these were orders linked to the S&P 500. So they knew when they would get the transaction from the portfolio manager at Putnam, they would then release these transactions at the end of the day. And they were all transactions. So this is now in the background with, again, a big sea change occurring. The technology now is robust. We're handling 259 share days. We have our books on the floor. And the technology is being able to incorporate all of the information flows and these products of options and futures and cash and being able to respond to what the institutions, where they were headed, which was passive management and indexing to the various indices, particularly the S&P 500. So, you know, again, it was technology enabling an entire new industry to develop.
But you said that they were reconciling things at the end of the day with
well,
shoe
they
boxes?
Would, what they would do is they would present the orders to the specialists. So they would want to say, I'm a buyer of so much IBM, I'm a buyer. And all of this was to ensure that they were in balance with what the index price was for the S&P 500. So if an index today, the S&P, let's just pick 1,000 for a while. But let's say the S&P index at that point was 250. That index price dictated what were the shares of IBM, GM, AT&T. And you knew, so what would happen is the portfolio manager would say, I want to buy 500 S&P. And the broker-dealers would then have to replicate that in the cash markets to make sure that they could deliver against the futures piece that they bought in the S&P.
So they'd sort of recreate the day's business or something?
They would actually put you in both. They would either undo the future or they would get you into the cash or undo the cash. So they were doing all these transactions, but very manually.
Yeah, it's sort of a low-tech way
very
to bring
low
all tech. This high-tech stuff together.
Exactly. So this is 1985. This is not that long ago. So we put together this idea that we could have the institutions and the broker-dealers preload all of these portfolios of stocks. And instead of delivering them manually, they could trigger them right at the close. They could go through DOT, get executed, and all be back in their offices in a matter of seconds. 30 seconds, whatever. That was a big deal. So that all took off. We had all the major firms using our DOT software to manage these big portfolios. And, of course, you remember, volume just surged. And then, in the meantime, we're trying to get the specialists to adopt these books. And so, you know, we're making some progress. Maybe a third of the floor is done. And I was asked in September of 87 to run the trading floor, to go down and run the operation. And I was 35 years old. No woman had ever done this. And so I said, yes, I would love to do it. It was a big management job. There were 800 people working for the exchange at the time. And so anyway, I went.
And you're dealing with sort of the tradition of tradition.
Oh, yeah.
The guy, the specialist on the floor.
Yeah.
Some of whom I suppose have been there for half a century.
Yeah. Absolutely. The industry.
How did you sort of gain everyone's confidence?
Well, it was a little challenging because, remember, I was the technology face at the time. So I was the person who was managing these other products. I was the person who was doing the list processing. You know, so I was a little bit of the devil themselves because, you know, they saw me as the sort of disruptive force. And so it was challenging, but the best thing that happened, talk about disruptive forces, was the board approved this in September. I take the job, and October comes, and the world gets turned inside out. So, you know, every process that we had was completely turned over. We worked immediately to figure out how to get all of the entire floor on the electronic books because the people who had them did much better in managing risk, understanding where their positions were, We worked to automate the back end, so we went to T5 clearing, completely automated, so that the firms didn't have to resubmit things. If the order came in through the system, it went all the way through to clearance and settlement through the system.
So you started that right after the market
break. Right after 87, yeah, because we had innumerable problems, which you can go back and document.
And you couldn't, of course, shut down and build all that and then start up. You were doing it piece by piece.
Correct.
How long did it take till you had this system revamped?
I think it went very quickly, actually. I would say within 18 months. We had really modified the processes and procedures. The entire floor was on the electronic book. I think that catalyst for change was pushed everybody very quickly.
Okay. Something that's in with this that gets back to your first job, which is the idea of self-regulation and the governance.
Right.
When it's all personal transactions, there's a lot that can sort of take place in the interstices.
Right.
Did this automation and these new systems make a change there as far as the way people did business day to day and how accountable it was?
Yeah, I think it certainly changed the process of doing it. It changed the process of doing business in the sense that they had different tasks and the way things, but the basic price discovery, the responsibility for their market, the responsibility for committing capital when supply and demand were disconnected, all of those basic missions of both the floor and the specialist were still intact. It was surrounded by an enormous amount of technology to help them fulfill those missions, given the volume and the volatility of the market, and really the birth of all of these other products. And I think it was in 87 when everybody declared the markets were linked.
Hmm.
Now, the one thing that never happened until, until 2000 when we had the other difficulties with the specialist, we never linked regulation with the trading. In other words, trading went on, and we surveilled and did all of our enforcement and review after the fact. The systems today are linked. And there are times when we would prevent something from happening.
You couldn't do that back then.
We could not do that back then.
Did this cross anyone's mind that this was might become possible with the technology where essentially you could capture everything step by step by step?
Well, I think what regulation got comfortable with was they did have everything. Everything was captured step by step by step. I mean, there were timestamps on everything all the way through. Now, not, the timestamps weren't in milliseconds, but they were certainly in minutes and seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So I think regulation felt that in those days they had made, a big leap forward because everything, when I got there, you were looking at things, but you might be looking at it days later. They were able to, in the next morning, being looking at capital positions. It had made a great stride forward. But I think there was an important point here, and that was we didn't want to stop trading for a violation of a rule because you're not really sure whether that's true. And, disrupting the flow of trading was not the thing you ever wanted to do. You never wanted to shut down, and you never wanted to stop trading. If you could, if there was any reason that you could possibly keep it open, you did.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about upgrading post 1987, and I guess you did that.
We really updated then, and then we did in 1992. We started another completely new technology project to revamp the floor using distributed processing, networking capability, linking all the floors, putting the firms on our networks. I mean, it was a very fundamental change, and it was born out of, I think, a much greater acceptance of the technology, a much greater understanding that it was now a facilitator, an enabler of business, And I think the technology itself had come so much further in its cost, its reduction of cost, its speed. We wanted to give brokers handheld terminals so they too could be brought in, because remember, the specialists were getting, they were, the specialists at this point were almost 99% electronic, because they were getting most of their order flow coming from through the systems from the broker dealers. But we still had about 30% of the volume that the brokers were doing on paper. So we had to bring, so that was the early 90s. I would say we embarked on that in 1992 and we finished it up in 95. It took us 3 years to completely revamp all the hardware, all the software, all the networks, everything. And that was the last big project I did when I was working in operations technology.
And then you moved up to a vice president position?
Then I actually, by then, oh gosh, I had been, when I became head of the floor, I was a senior VP, and then I moved up to EVP, and then, because I took on technology as well as operations. And then in 95, when Dick Grasso became the chairman, he asked this other gentleman and I to swap roles. And I went to the listing side of the business, which was a revenue producer. So for the first time, I was actually bringing in revenue. And I had a lot of other roles. I had internal audit. I mean, I had a bunch of things. And I was a group EVP at that point. And so I went into the listing side of the business. And then when Bill Johnston retired in 2001, right after 9/11, Dick Grasso made Bob Ritz and I co-presidents of the exchange. And we took on that role in 2002.
Tell me a little bit about the exchange when Dick Grasso came in, and what his, you know, did he want to do more of the same, or did he want to change things?
Yeah.
What was his vision?
I think Dick was, well, first of all, I do think Dick wanted to change things. I think he was very much bought into the notion of technology as the enabler and a builder of business. I think Dick was extremely close, though, to the membership, very close to the floor. They respected him. They loved him. He had been, you know, there for many years. He had come up on the listing side. So he, you know, when John Phelan was the chairman, he put Dick in charge of it. He did the same thing to Dick on the other side. He put him out of listings and into operations. And there was a gentleman who ran listings. So... you know, I think Dick came into the role in operations in the 90s, and I do think that he, you know, saw change. But Dick was, to me, Dick's greatest contribution to the exchange was he was an incredible marketer. He built the brand, the international brand of the exchange. He knew how to get things done. He knew how to convince the companies that, you know, the New York Stock Exchange was the only place to be. Now, by now, we were in competition with NASDAQ. It had come up. It had its own, you know, it had been through its own trials and tribulations. And when it did go through those, it built up its brand in a way that it had to. It strengthened technology. So we were competing with them for listings. And they had, at the time, in the 90s, all of the high-tech companies, the Microsofts, the Intels.
And they were selling that big time.
And they were selling it big time until you know, 2003 when the bubble burst. So, you know, we were very much then competing with NASDAQ. That was the competition, again, with the broker-dealers who continued to become very powerful in their ability to trade.
Right. But as long as the technology is, again, feeding back to the specialist, then this base of power or support is still intact, I guess.
Correct.
And Grasso didn't have any intent of
No, I think it actually worked very well. I mean, I think up to that point, it was working extremely well. I think, you know, in hindsight, with the benefit of hindsight, we probably should have done a little bit more automation in the sense of the execution. But it changed, and you see it now. It fundamentally changes the way price discovery occurs. And I think, you know, things were working fine and were working very well. And there wasn't really the you know, at that moment, the push to make that one last, close that one last loop. And the specialists were still doing well and were still committing capital. I think that, I think one of Dick's great contributions was that he built the exchange into, I think, one of the greatest global brands. And we were really at the top of our game.
What does it mean to do listings, which is what you started
sure.
doing?
What we did was we would go to companies. Well, there were two parts of listings. One was to bring companies in. There were really three parts. One was to bring them in. One was to take care of them while they were with you as in their life as a public company. So that meant doing things like press releases, dividends, all kinds of processing that goes on, actually, when a company is public. And the last piece was to do oversight of their compliance with the listing standards, because we were basically telling the world these were companies with certain financial meeting certain financial criteria, meeting certain governance standards. So that was, and we also set the standards for governance in those, and still do, I believe, for what a board had to look like, how it operated, that kind of thing.
Well, that gets to one of the interesting questions: is NASDAQ's benefiting from the dot-com bubble, and they're benefiting, even earlier, they're benefiting from the general understanding that it's easier to get listed on your NASDAQ.
Sure, it was.
But when NASDAQ is really taking off in the late 90s, did you start thinking about doing something with your entries, your standards,
yes.
your rules to county?
Yes. So I came in 95, and in early 96, we changed the organization, recruited some people, and we also started to look at our listing standards, because it was very clear that we were the home for very stable, very large companies, but we weren't really the home. We didn't take that many risks on IPOs, which was also a very big part of bringing companies in. So we did a couple things. We opened an office in Silicon Valley so that we could be closer to the banking teams and to the companies and to the law firms that were really in the flow of business. We looked at our listing standards and we made modifications to accept companies on a cash flow basis, and then really to later, about 2 years later, to accept companies on revenues as long as they had a certain market cap. So it was $1 billion initially and revenues of $250 million.
Were these, in some sense, relaxing standards?
No, I think it really was much more of certainly was changing standards. To the degree that it wasn't what we had, I guess you could say that was a change. But I think it was much more recognition that, getting companies to move off of NASDAQ became more and more and more challenging because their brand was going up and they had the sort of new companies, and for them, they branded that and marketed it very aggressively. And so if you for a while before the bubble burst, it was, why would you want to be there? That was, remember, old economy, new economy, remember we went through that? So, I think from our perspective, it really wasn't a recognition that if we wanted to build the companies of the future, we really needed to take more of a risk with young companies. But we had to have companies that were a certain size and a certain, where we thought they had a likelihood of succeeding.
A good risk.
Yeah. And so we built out, with the SEC's help, a set of parameters around what we were prepared to do. And we were successful.
And at some point there's this, I was talking to Frank Zarb, and he's here. We were in a war.
Yeah.
Where basically, and you were doing listings at the time,
yes.
So you would have been on the front lines. Aside from sort of bringing this new face to what the stock exchange could offer, what other things did you do? I mean, there's the truism that the stock exchange is always going to be the most efficient
right.
mechanism.
So I think we did three things. One, I think over here we kept the brand. We kept building the brand internationally. So we would travel to China. We would, Dick was doing, and we were all building that brand. We were looking at the standards and figuring out how we could go after the companies that we thought would build our brand for the future, so we could, really beat NASDAQ in that space. They probably would still get the small companies, but we would get the ones that, we really thought were the comers, the future stars. We also changed how stocks got allocated, which was a huge deal. So in 1997, we made a change that said that be, company could come and interview specialists and choose their specialists. Hmm. Because there used to be an allocation committee, and the committee of insiders allocated the stocks, the franchises, to the various specialists. And that was a huge, and it really did change. We went from, 54 specialist units down to probably 20, 15 or 20 very, very quickly, because they either didn't have the capital or the stature or the technology or whatever it was. Because, when AOL came in from NASDAQ and said, okay, well, why should I give you, why do I want to pick you? So we went into a selection by the company. That was huge.
Yeah, so suddenly the ones with the track record are all getting chosen. You're washing out lots of others.
Correct.
Was there a negative to that? Was there a downside?
Well, it became a little bit of a beauty contest, and people were getting very aggressive. And I think, that it changed the sort of, in some ways, the collegial nature among the specialist community. But, I think it was the right thing to do. And I would say that the last piece, as I said, was opening the office in Silicon Valley. We adjusted our fees also slightly to make sure that we kept people very happy.
One of the things that, looking over on NASDAQ side,
sure,
they had, their big crack up with the odd eights.
Right.
And you had the division of regulation and the commercial function.
Correct.
Was there any sense that this was something that the stock exchange might be looking at sooner or later?
You mean the separation of the two functions?
Splitting off regulation.
No, I don't think so. I think there was always a view, and even in both in fact and in operation, regulatory group operated very separately. I mean, we would laugh. They were part of our company, but the notion that we influenced them they were in a different building. They were at 55 Water Street for a very long time. So we were very set. Other than the people who did market surveillance, because they needed to be close to the market, they would go down there and do things.
Right.
Everybody else was in a completely different building, completely different management. So
would people move back and forth, though? I mean, you yourself moved from regulation.
Yeah. Sometimes. We always thought it was really good to move people back and forth because they got a better appreciation and understanding for the other side. So some people did, but I was probably, there weren't too many of us that moved back and forth that much.
I think I saw somewhere that there were times when it was hard to keep people and enforce it.
Yeah.
There was a lot of turnover.
Right. To be honest, I'm really going to say that I don't know the answer to that, because I didn't bump into them that often, happily.
Well, talk about some of the things you were doing then, moving in the late 90s into 2000.
So, as I said, I went in and really looked at this listings and knew that our goal was to try to get some of the big companies to move off of NASDAQ, but also to build a base for the future. Our list turned over about every 10 years. Our list would literally, still true today. I mean, I'm sure if you went through the statistic between M&A, which is the principal reason companies left. So we were doing all that. We had an audit when I first got there. Lori Richards' group came in, and we didn't do very well on the audit of our compliance oversight of our listing standards. So we had to then build out a very, very robust compliance function for the listings group. And
what's involved in compliance there?
Well, it was really it was absolutely having availability of the financials of the company on a monthly basis, quarterly basis, annual basis. So we were really tracking their financials. It was looking at all of the standards for governance, for the board, for all the construction, and tracking companies if they went below our listing standards and putting them on warning or watch or delisting them. I mean, up to the time I got there, it was hard for me to find any company that was delisted.
Yeah. Was this after Enron had happened and there was all the...
No, this was actually a little bit before that. This was before that, and then Enron and all that happened subsequently.
And I suppose you got even more...
We got even more aggressive after that.
What did your customers, the companies, I mean, were they happy to keep dishing out more and more information? Or
well,
was there
the
some
good
pushback?
News was that a lot of the information was publicly disclosed. Remember, the SEC gets, they have the oversight and responsibility for disclosure. So a lot of this information was available. We simply told the companies that, we had standards and we were going to enforce them. It was our responsibility to do that. So I think, and actually even for companies that got in trouble, we're very grateful because, we gave them time, we put in processes and procedures. So if you fell below our standards, you presented us with a plan. And we had a team of people and a compliance committee that actually looked at it and said, well, Ken has zero chance of making this plan work. We're going to have to delist it. So I think the companies were grateful that, I think they understood. They didn't like it necessarily, but they understood. And when they were in trouble, they were grateful that we had people there who were trying to help them actually restore their health or make a transition if that's what had to happen.
From your position as the head of this function, what were you spending most of your time doing?
I would say three things. One, developing the strategy, because this at the time is 37% of the revenue listings. I mean, it's a huge contributor. So it's transaction fees, market data, and listings. And listings is the single largest. So this is a big deal. So I'm trying to think about the strategy of how we're going to be able to make sure that we're continuing to contribute this kind of revenue to the company and, in fact, to grow it. And in the meantime, the fellow who ran international left, and so, well, anyway, we can get to that later. But in any event, so strategy was one part. How are we going to compete with NASDAQ? Because they were really our main competitor for listings. Number two, I was also had other responsibilities other than just listings. I was on the management committee. I was so, I had my exchange hat I wore in the senior management. Dick was the three of us, Dick and Bob and I. And then I would say compliance was a big thing because I really felt we needed to strengthen the governance and the compliance of our companies. Because at the end of the day, the thing companies were most proud of was that they were listed on the New York Stock Exchange. And we wanted that to still mean everything to them and to the investors who were buying those stocks. So it was really important, really important. So I would say that that's kind of how I spent my time in trying to market and build and strategy. And I made a lot of calls with the team. I traveled a lot.
Visited a lot of companies.
Oh, I visited a lot of companies.
Walk across a lot of shop floors.
Absolutely. Visited a lot of management teams. Greeted them when they came to the exchange. It was best job.
You were bringing your concerns about the strategizing to the management committee.
Absolutely.
What other issues were front and center in those discussions for where's the exchange going as a whole?
Well, I think there was always the question about how far to take the technology. We went in a direction of doing, we put something in that before Dick left in 2002, which did automatically execute trades. So we started down that path before because we were going to have to go there. The volumes we were doing were just, you could see we're going to necessitate further and further and further creation. And it was also really important, this was a very symbiotic relationship. The listing, the trading, all worked together, and you wanted to have the market share.
Who was doing technology at that point?
Bob Britz was, so I had the listings and a lot of the, I had the functions, like as I said, internal audit. I also had regulation at that point. In 2002, Dick asked me if I would take regulation. So I now had the full responsibility for regulation as well as listings. And Bob Britz had technology and operations. And he actually had SIAC reporting to him at this point. SIAC had been separate and reporting to Dick, so they were reporting to Bob. So we really had quite a separation, again, of the technology and the issue.
If you had regulation, this is a big time to have regulation. This is 2002, and
yes.
Corporate governance is everywhere.
Right, and we had just done, after Enron and WorldCom, and before Sarbanes-Oxley, we had established a blue ribbon panel, which put out its findings in 2002.
Was that with NASDAQ?
Actually, we did it ourselves. We did not work with NASDAQ on it, but the SEC made NASDAQ adopt everything we did. So this was in the context of independent audit committee, all of that. A lead director had to be assigned. The board had to meet with them. There's a whole report about it. You can find it, I'm sure. Yeah. So we did, again, asserting our leadership role in the governance arena. So when you asked me what I was doing, I was like, oh my gosh, we were doing a lot of different things. So that was also in the context of both our regulatory responsibility and our listings responsibility. They went very well together.
Okay. So in with the corporate accountability and all that stuff.
Right.
Then we get Chairman Donaldson coming out and saying, I want to know all the exchanges. I want them to be transparent.
Right, right.
What was behind that?
It makes total sense. I mean, I think the exchanges were setting the standards for disclosure and transparency for the companies. And, you know, he said, you know, I think the exchanges have to follow suit. You're setting the standards. You've got to stand up and do what's right.
So it was cause and effect.
It was. It absolutely was. And it was the right thing.
Did you think that it would shake out the way it did?
No. Never. Never. No idea.
It seemed like an overreaction to some extent.
I certainly think, you know, it was interesting. I think the standards that we had set were the right standards. I think everything was fine until WorldCom hit. And then the world, you know, it's a little bit like today. You know, everybody's calling for the government to step in and do something. And honestly, I can say I think the SEC, I think the self-regulatory process is the right one. It's not perfect. Everybody doesn't do everything perfectly all the time, but it is the right system. And, you know, I think Sarbanes-Oxley was a complete overreaction, and it hurt us competitively for a long time.
But then, in the aftermath of this, you did split off the regulation.
We did ultimately split. So, but that happened after John Thain. So, Dick left. We ushered in even more automation. We really set out then to be a public company, to be, you know, fully transparent.
Now, in the tales of Dick Grasso, or the stories of Dick Grasso, there's always this sort of Greek chorus of specialists right. out there, you know, who are with him and against him. And,
right.
and did you see that phenomenon?
Oh,
did you
yeah.
see that?
I think it was always, you know, I think it's back to your earlier question. You know, this was a, in my view, it was a love-hate relationship. You know, I mean, I think nobody loved, appreciated, and did more for the business of the New York Stock Exchange and Dick. And I think every one of the members knew that. On the other side, however, the job was change. The job was pushing us to a different place. I mean, that's what good businesses do. They change, and they respond to the environment, or, you know, push ahead of the environment that they're in. And so, again, it was, you know,
so
they loved him, but they, you know, it was always the pushing and pulling.
Was it that Grasso wanted too much change, or was it that the change that the exchange needed wasn't coming?
No, I think it was more the amount of change they knew that had to come. It wasn't that it wasn't coming, it was going to come.
Okay.
But it was, you know, and, you know, again, it was just more of a, there generally were people on the floor who were pretty, there were some very, very, very enlightened people who knew exactly what was happening and knew what was going to happen. So
when did you find out or meet John Thain and know that he was going to come into this position?
Well, you know, this all unraveled very quickly for Dick, and so I remember he left on the night of September 17th in 2003. And the next day we were all bored, you know, everyone. So anyway, they had a was Paul McCall-McKinley, director, and we then certainly went to a meeting on Saturday to try to find somebody who would chair. John Reed was selected and took the position. So that was in early October. And he came to the exchange, and then in January he called us in to tell us that he had convinced John Thain to join the exchange as the CEO, and that his plan was to leave in a year, give him some time to transition, but to be gone in a year. And so he would like us to meet with John Thain. So in January, I shook John Thain's hand at the IPO at Goldman Sachs. That was first and only time I'd ever even talked to John Thain. And so he came in and he met with us, and I really loved working for him. I think he had a very hard job to do coming in, because he was hit by a barrage of things, whether it was management issues for the people, whether it was the investigation then that ensued with the regulatory side with the specialist. He had to do the technology changes that were inevitable. He had a very tough job, but I think he was the right person, and he took us public, I'm sure that will be debated forevermore, but we certainly weren't the first to do that, and so in the environment, I think it was the right thing to get us in a competitive position.
Did he say right away that he was going to not only take the exchange public, but take the technology to its logical?
He was a really, really thoughtful guy. He spent a lot of the first couple of months on the floor. And so he was an engineer. And he spent a couple of months on the floor. Every single day he was down on that floor for a lot of the time, just observing, watching, standing with the traders, watching the specialists, doing this. He'd say to me, well, why couldn't we do this? And we'd say, well, John, we do that. We just only do it this much. We don't do it this much. And, I'd say, well, what would be the reasons not to do that? And so we'd go through them, and what would be the reasons to do that? And so I think we all had a very good, it was hard. He had a very tough job. And in the background of all this is, as you said, the Greek chorus of, what's the future of the New York Stock Exchange? So he had a tough job.
Were you in on the discussions with Art Chappell?
Yes. That was a process that took place over. John also brought McKinsey in very early to help develop a strategy for the exchange. And so we were very much a part of the strategy, discussions, what was the right time. But I would say, I would say that there were others who were much more at the forefront of that. I definitely had a view, and it was kind of amazing sometimes to go into some of the meetings that occurred at the exchange after with, Jerry Putnam, Duncan Niederauer, Rick Ketchum. I mean, these were people who were, in a different space, and I just would say, no one would believe this if someone had told me this was going to happen, I would have said that's.
And very quickly, too.
And very quickly. Yeah. So anyway, I can't say that I was, I was at the forefront of that deal by any stretch. I think we all knew we had to do something. And I think John had the brilliant stroke of doing that merger because it got us public in a stroke of a pen as opposed to the agony that it would have taken. It was already hard, but it would have been almost impossible.
And at the same time, then, I guess, the implications of going public.
Oh, gosh, yeah. And the members and, what that meant. Many were for it. Many had seen CME and, the great success that had occurred there. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of push for it because at this point, remember, seed prices are declining. It's 2004, right? 2005, seed prices are really plummeting. The members had been very well treated because they all had been leasing their seats. Because remember, in the early 80s, the SEC ruled against us and said that somebody could lease their seat. Because previously, you had to own your seat and work your seat. So the SEC ruled against us, and I think that there are certain changes that occurred in the business that I think were very set a path I think that was one of them.
No kidding. Explain that to me. Just
because I think I think we've come full circle to the issues that we're discussing right now. When it's other people's money, behaviors, risk taking, lots of things occur in a very different way.
Gotcha.
If you were the person who owned that seat and you were running that seat, but later what happened, people came in and they didn't ever own a seat, they didn't have their capital in it, they were renting the seat and they were an operator on the floor. Now, they were very much at odds in the membership context. Those people, the lessees, were very much at odds with the lessors. The lessors had a valuable asset that the only way they could equitize was, or get equity in was to go public. The lessees, this was their job. They made their living here. The lessees paid the lessors a lot of money. And over the years, I don't know, I forget what the average price of a seat was, but let's say it was $250,000. I mean, those leases were going for $350,000 a year and for a number of years. So the lessors got very restless because the seat prices were going down. They were earning less on their leases. Anyway, it was a maelstrom.
So all the while, you're still doing, you're still out there doing the marketing and listings, right?
Right. And working, you know, I'm still on the management committee. We're still doing all our strategy. We're still working on the technology. We're trying to make sure, you know, we were all in it then because we wanted to go quickly.
And the next big front is international. Can you give me a little bit of the backstory to that?
Okay.
How much had been done previous to your
next? I think a lot had been done. Dick really got that start. Well, I would say John Phelan really got it started. In 1986, John Phelan took a delegation to China and met with Deng Xiaoping. I mean, I promise you, if you go on websites in China, that is still there. He met him in the People's Hall. That was followed on, you know, on Nixon, you know, opening up of China. So the notion of the capital markets capitalism coming to China, oh my God, this, and, you know, Deng Xiaoping had those two very famous things, you know, and how will we make China great? And he said, we'll make some rich, some will be rich first. And a second one that everybody always talked about was, you know, what's the difference between the black cat and the white cat? And he said, they both catch mice, you know. So there was not going to be any difference. There was going to be a capitalist kind of mentality. So anyway, that really, in my view, ushered in the beginning of the exchange being viewed as the international place, and capitalism was moving. And so I think the exchange saw itself in a role. Whether it went to Russia, it went to Russia, then went to China, all over the world. And it was really bringing the message of capitalism at a time when people were very eager to have that message. So that was in the 90s. John Phelan left in 90. Donaldson picked it up then for 3 years. He did a lot in trying to get things. There were some, I think, heated moments with the SEC relative to that, to the international nature of the markets. And then Dick, all the while, was in listings at this point and then into operations, but he really did a lot to travel all over the world. There was a listings group that did international. I was only doing domestic at that point. So there was a team of people that did international listings. And we had opened an office in London. We had an office in Tokyo. We did a lot with the Tokyo Stock Exchange. So in any event, it ushered in a whole era of internationalization of capital markets. And Dick was really, John started it. They all contributed in their own way to advancing that.
Was there a sense that this was building really quickly, though, going
absolutely.
Into the 2000s?
Absolutely. Yes, it was definitely building. We were getting record numbers of international companies coming to the exchange. Every privatization of a major company around the world came as a second or a dual listing in New York. So, you know, the biggest Russian telecom companies, the biggest Chinese insurance companies, the biggest So we own the space in the international markets.
Now, did you get the assignment to deal with Euronext? Because I know you ended up going to France, right?
Right, I did. Well, what happened was the... it was interesting. In the early 90s, Jean-François Théodore came to the exchange. I was running technology at the time, and he wanted to buy some software that we had built to optimize the performance of a number of the technologies we had developed. And it was Tandem, which ultimately became Compact, which ultimately became HP. So we had worked with Tandem to build something called nonstop processing. So this was, you know, in the vein of reliability. And we were known to have done some very special things with that. And Tandem put us in touch with Jean-François Théodore, who had this vision of putting all the markets in Europe together. And he was going to use a lot of the technology we had built for ITS and for our own systems, our own books, electronic books. He was going to use a lot of that software and hardware. So he wanted to buy this, and it was the first, so I met him then, and it was the first commercial deal we ever did, selling software to what was the Paris Bourse at that time, which ultimately became Euronext. And he actually fulfilled his vision. He put five exchanges together, including Lyon. So anyway, you know, again, John Thane was there, you know, there was a lot going on. But again, in the context of the big McKinsey study that we had done for the board and the strategy, there was a domestic strategy, but there was, John had created this strategy that we needed to be more diverse from a product perspective, both product perspective and a geographic perspective, and that we needed to have a futures. We needed to have a, because that was really where the growth was going to come. That, you know, and I think he was absolutely right on the money, that the equities business was going to get more and more challenging. The futures and derivatives businesses were going to be the growth engine, and that they were much more monopolies, actually, than the equities markets were. They're very transparent, very low cost. You know, they're ubiquitous. So he embarked on, you know, we were working with both, we were trying to decide which was the best, you know, which was our greatest opportunity, and Euronext was the opportunity we landed on, and John closed the deal, and then he wanted someone to go to lead the U.S. team to go, and it was the four of us went. So, and I, you know, it was a natural because we were doing international listings. I was spending a lot of time traveling to China anyway, so it was a lot easier from Paris and India and all those places. So,
and French.
And I knew a little French, enough to stay alive. And I knew Jean-François, and I respected him a great deal. And, it was a really exciting time for us. And I knew at some point I was going to retire. I mean, 35 years, I said to John, before I went, you know, this will be my last assignment.
How much had you accomplished? How much have you done there?
By the time I got to France, we pretty much had, John had laid out the organization. We knew what we wanted to do. And when I got to France, I learned so much about what it is to, we have no idea what it's like to work in another culture. And, you know, until I got there, I didn't know either. Even John, I mean, to this day, I think, none of us really. We knew what it was on a piece of paper, but
right.
Living it is different.
So that's probably still something that the exchange is dealing with.
Absolutely.
These
it's a 22-person board, the governance structure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but it was the right thing.
Terrific. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that we should?
I don't think so. I think, you know, so much of it's chronicled and the press and all over. I guess the only thing I'd say is the exchange, in my mind, had the incredible, incredible knack of having the right person running it at the right time. It was just remarkable to watch in 35 years. You know, some organizations don't get that lucky. You know, they and even our own organization, given some of the possibilities in the mix of consideration, might not have yielded the same result. And it was remarkable for all of its, you know, for all of its challenges and difficulties. It is an amazing institution, iconic institution.
A very interesting time.
Interesting time, interesting history, interesting people. And it was a magnet, you know. Even, you know, you could look at all of the things that have gone on in its history and look at what's going on today, and it just, it is, it's, you know, it is definitely an industry of fear and greed, as its two cycles, and it just, it vacillates in, within those two cycles. And periodically we get these periods of peace, and then we get these incredible cataclysms. But it's the cataclysms that push the change, because it just is not, it's hard to change in a more stable, peaceful environment. And
something very human about that.
Anyway, it's terrific. The greatest industry, and I wouldn't have changed.
How many other liberal arts majors did you meet along the way as you went through this?
There were a number of them. Yeah, I think there were a fair number of liberal arts majors. A lot, you know, I would say the predominant people I met along the way were lawyers. So, you know, most of the people in at least at the exchange, a lot of had legal training. You know, of course, there were the technology people, but a fair number of liberal arts people, but a lot of financial people and a lot of lawyers.
Well, I was struck by your discussion of regulation running around saying, well, we have liberal arts majors if you want to use them, as if they're some kind of special, special animal.
It's
good to have folks taking a different perspective on this.
Absolutely, and I think it was, we were all, you know, even on the technology side, a lot of us were being trained on the job. I mean, think about it, late 70s, the PC wasn't even online until 82, so, you know, people were engineers. There were computer science majors. That sort of came in the late 70s, early 80s. First crop probably was. So it was just a very different environment.
Good time to think big.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.